Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Blaw from TIFO Football, and the broadcaster, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan. It's a funny old game. Manchester United have been through the mill this season. They've been mocked, criticised, and second-guessed. Hands up, we've often doubted the managerial ability of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Yet, they're unbeaten in 13, and playing with pace, penetration, and fluency. They kick off the FA Cup quarterfinals at Norwich on Saturday. Now, it doesn't take too much to imagine them winning the trophy at a deserted Wembley, does it, Jordan?
No, it doesn't. I think they'll be one of the favourites to lift the FA Cup, considering, I mean, form is a bit of a nebulous term right now. We've only got a couple of games back in since the pandemic and lockdown, but I was one of those people that was very, very critical of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I still, when I close my eyes, can't still understand how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the Manchester United manager. That for me still, even now, it hasn't computed yet. It just feels wrong in so many ways. And I've been critical of him being the guy that will take United back to glory. However, I'm a fair guy. I'm the harshest critic when I think it's valid. But you've got to give praise where it's due also as well. He's with the signing of Bruno Fernandes, it's a little bit like he's waved the wand and everything seems to have gone his way. I still don't think he's the guy to take them back to where they really ultimately want to be. But I think he is the guy that could win them an FA Cup. And I think that the current squad that he's got, the momentum that he's got, the players back from injury that he's now got, I don't see Norwich causing them any problems in this particular fixture. And I don't think they'll be fearful of anybody left in the competition. I don't think people will be shaking their boots playing them particularly, but I don't think they will be looking at anybody left and thinking, we want to avoid them. I think that with the Pogba, Fernandes / I guess, I don't know, McTominay, Matic axis, that is something that I think can get them to the end of the season and really give them a drive to try and get that Champions League spot and nail the cup. But I will give Solskjaer some credit, all caveating by saying that I still don't think he's a brilliant manager and I don't think he's the guy that they want long-term to get them back to where they want to be.
What does he have to do, Seb, to prove himself to you? Because I know you were probably nodding assiduously when Jordan was speaking there.
I want... See, Jordan's a fair guy and I'm not. I'm stubborn and I will stick to my opinions. I will die on all sorts of hills, and especially with this. Mike, I have to see a bit more organic growth. We've mentioned Aaron Wan-Bissaka before and he's evolved as a footballer over the course of the year. That's very impressive. What I want to see is improvement over a long period of time, which doesn't depend on spending £60 million on a playmaker. Like, because it's unfair to criticise a manager for something he can't distance himself from. But then it conflates the issue, doesn't it? I mean, if you can spend that amount of money in the middle of a season and bring a player of the quality of Bruno Fernandes into your side, then I don't really know how to separate the two things. I want to see consistent top four finishes for a couple of years. I want him to evolve tactically. So I want to see Manchester United win big games against high-powered opponents where it doesn't just involve them sitting deep and breaking. I think, let me just clarify, because I'm not criticising him for that strategy. I just mean that from a bystander's point of view, from an analytical point of view, it becomes very difficult to know what he is if his major successes to this point always depend on the same mechanism. And I know I've been harsh, and actually I'll row back on a little bit. I think he's done a lot better than I thought he was going to. When that first run of form ended in his first season, I didn't think he was going to come back from that. I thought that was terminal. He's proved me wrong there. But do I feel that he can compete? Do I feel, for instance, that he, over the course of a 38-game season, could outsmart someone like Jurgen Klopp if the two teams were equal? No. Do I think he could do it with Guardiola? No, despite the fact that he's beaten Guardiola several times in one-off fixtures. I think Manchester United's future will be determined by their dexterity, by their ability to beat different types of sides across an eight-month year in all kinds of competition. And I haven't seen that yet. I've seen him improve. I've seen him grow as a manager, absolutely. I've seen Manchester United get much better in all sorts of departments. But are these things consistent? Is this a permanent state? I'm not ready yet to sign that off.
Yeah, what struck me, obviously Sheffield United have hit a wall. But what did strike me about that performance on Wednesday night, the way that United played with a fluency that we haven't seen before, especially in that little sort of Rashford, Fernandes, Pogba triangle, as it were, you know, there was signs of people beginning to understand one another, and you know, a relationship growing. And obviously Pogba's not been around. That was his first start since September. So you look at that and you think, well, there is something here. And again, to play devil's advocate there, I look at Solskjaer. He can't be criticised for taking advantage of Manchester United's, you know, financial advantages, can he? You know, and Bruno Fernandes has come in and had a huge impact. Do you think that this is almost going to be, this FA Cup, it could even be the start of the Solskjaer era? Will we be talking in those terms?
I don't think so, only because I think Seb made a really good point about, and you kind of just backed it up there, about he can't be blamed for the fact that he's at a club with financial might. Well, my kind of counter to that is, what if we take out Bruno Fernandes, does it all fall apart then? And I think any manager that kind of relies on one or two quality players and that their success depends on that rather than a system like we're seeing at Manchester City. You can take out Kevin De Bruyne from Manchester City. You can take out two or three of their top players at Manchester City, but the system still stands in place for them to have a template to play football and be successful. I just don't see him anywhere near. I think he's two levels below the caliber of Klopp and Pep Guardiola. I think that he's going to have to try and etch above the likes of Frank Lampard. I think Jose Mourinho's on the slide, so maybe he's in that kind of race. I just don't see, even with, say, a Sancho and a better centre-back, because I'm still not convinced about Maguire. I'm not a big fan of his. I still think, as a manager, Manchester United Football Club needs somebody that has more layers to them in order to really get them back at the top table of competing for the biggest trophy. And I'm just not sure he's that guy. I think he's the guy that can deliver a cup. I think he's the guy that can deliver possibly top four. I don't think there's much more than that to him, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, they're a strange team in if you look at it statistically. You know, what is more telling? You know, 13 games without defeat or only 13 wins in 31 Premier League games. They've had 10 clean sheets in that unbeaten run, yet David De Gea has been getting pelters, hasn't he? Where one was that criticism, I noticed that Solskjaer defended De Gea and essentially said, look, he's going to be my number one next season as well, however promising Henderson might be. Is that wise?
I don't really know what else he can say, Mike. Whether it's wise or not, I'm not sure. But politically, David De Gea is on an enormous contract. He's one of the highest paid players in the division. I think he might even be the highest paid player in the division. It's very, very difficult if Solskjaer throws him under a bus now, because at the very worst, if Man United are to replace him, they've got to find a market for De Gea. They've got to, you know, he's got to recover his form before he leaves the club in any kind of profitable way. So it's difficult. I mean, I also I think we've covered this before. I don't see a landing spot for De Gea. Like, if you want to move him on, where are you moving him on to? He doesn't go anywhere. He's not going to Real Madrid or Barcelona. He's not going to Bayern Munich. They've obviously got Manuel Neuer and Alexander Nübel as of next season. He's not going to Juventus. Wojciech Szczesny has just really recovered his career. He looks like an excellent goalkeeper. So I'm not sure what the solution is. But then at the same time, Mike, you're kind of, for the sake of the rest of the season, this is what Ferguson would have done. You know, David De Gea can punt three into his own net on a Saturday afternoon, and Solskjaer still has to say he's the best in the world because Man United are paying him like he is the best in the world, and he's got no room to manoeuvre. And so I'll be critical of him in some capacity, but he was certainly Solskjaer. That's actually quite a good general point. Solskjaer was certainly paying attention to Ferguson's media handling over the years. Like in terms of how he defends players, also the subtleties with how he talks to players. Like if he's talking about like a young sort of 20, 25 year old player, he'll always refer to them as a boy, which is a Fergusonism, let's be honest. So in terms of his character and his behaviours and his tactics in public, he's quite smart. He's smarter than people think he is. And so, you know, whatever the question marks are against the football, that's certainly certainly something he has in his favour. I should have had more coffee, shouldn't I?
Sorry, Mike, just on the De Gea point, can I just quickly mention the fact that whilst I'm not convinced that De Gea is the solution or the answer next year for United, and I think it'll be hard to get rid of him for all the reasons that Seb has just given, I'm not entirely convinced that Henderson is the answer either. And I tell you why, because I think it's easier for Henderson to perform as he's been performing at Sheffield United. Being number one for Manchester United is a whole different kettle of fish. And let's not even forget, despite his season at Sheffield United, he has made some quite high-profile mistakes down there as well. What I think the best solution for Man United next season would be to bring Henderson in as number two to put that pressure on De Gea. I think De Gea is a victim of someone that's got no real pressure. Romero's a good goalkeeper, but he's never going to be a number one at United. I think United need to bring him back in and Henderson back in to be that shadow over De Gea to say, listen, if you keep messing up on being on this decline, I'm here. And super briefly on those two stats you flagged as well regarding United's form, I think that says a lot in itself because those two stats for a big club, neither are impressive. If you're meant to be a big club, none of those two stats are particularly impressive as far as I'm concerned. So that says a lot about, I think, maybe how we view Manchester United and an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer Manchester United today.
Yeah, further forward, you know, there are signs that it's being knitted together. Anthony Martial now 19 goals in all competition, his first hat-trick, United's first hat-trick since 2013. Marcus Rashford against Sheffield United, two assists. Seems a bit of a daft question, but have United got enough goals in them, Seb?
I think they might do, because you touched on Martial there, and I see a slightly different player in him at the moment. He's always been very, very gifted. I don't think that's a secret. But one of the sort of the strategies this season with him specifically has been to get him heading for the near post more often, scoring the kind of a more typical kind of centre forwards goal. I think you're seeing that. I think sort of he's technically an outstanding footballer. But I think sometimes he could be guilty of being a little bit passive in games, particularly when he was used from like a wide forward role. Now, I mean, I know it's a very small sample, so let's not get carried away. But if you add in, for instance, the goal he scored against Stamford Bridge before the lockdown, that near post header across Kepa, brilliant header, and some of the couple of the goals that he scored last night, you're seeing a more instinctive style of play. And so I wonder if you were to tune Martial in to be a more orthodox number nine, I think he could score an awful lot of goals. I mean, volume wouldn't be a problem if you could fit him into the tapestry well enough. You could sew him in. I started the year thinking that United need to spend heavily on a nine, like not a replacement for Lukaku because he wasn't a success at Old Trafford, but that kind of player. You know, a focal point in your formation. Now I'm not so sure, and that's actually a credit to Solskjaer, and it's definitely a credit to Martial, who looks rejuvenated. I mean, consider in every sense what he was under Mourinho, unhappy, underperforming, wanting an exit by all accounts, and now he's starting to look like the player they bought from Monaco.
Let's look at Norwich. You quite rightly dismissed them, Jordan, and they do look they do look nailed on for relegation. The cup's all they've got left. I suppose the question, again, this might be seen as harsh, but are enough questions being asked of Daniel Farke?
Yes, I think there are actually. I think that Norwich came into the season with a policy where they wasn't going to try and spend their way to stay in the league. You know, we've seen in previous seasons that can work and cannot work. It might have been a policy whereby they may have expected to go back down, but if we're going to go back down, we're not going to go down with a huge wage bill, as we've seen with other clubs that have gone down before. Let's not forget the first third of the season anyway. Norwich started the season pretty well and they were getting quite a lot of credit for the style of football, sticking to their principles. Some people called it naive, but they didn't have the worst start to the season. I think if you're going to question Daniel Farke, you have to then back it up by saying, well, what should he be doing? If the club are not going to be spending their way to stay in the league like Aston Villa tried to do, for example, well, I think with the players that he's got, I don't know if it's much more that he could have done with the cards that he's been dealt personally. I don't think they've been shocking. I've heard the phrase before, they're the best worst team in Premier League history, and I think that's a fair shout. A backhanded compliment that you don't really want to have. But I think questions have been asked of him, and I'm not sure what else you could have expected of him to do with that particular squad.
The focus is always on the coaches, isn't it? Now, there is a lot of focus at the moment on Mikel Arteta. Arsenal are at Sheffield United in the Cup. The problems are growing. Let's put it like that. Let's look at the issue in the round here, Seb. We all know that the reality is that there are power networks in modern football. You've only got to look at, Mendes at Wolves, for instance. But there are huge question marks over recruitment strategy at Arsenal, and a lot of people are murmuring about the influence of Keir Durabjian, the agent. You know, he has every right to do his business, but if you look at Arsenal, there is a club. The mood music is very discordant, isn't it?
You know what troubles me most, Mike, is let's simplify this. So, as far as I'm aware, and please jump in and correct me either of you guys if I get this wrong. So we've got Eddie Gaspar, sporting director. We've got Raul Sanlihi, who has a recruiting function as well, and according to reports, seems to prefer to deal with a very small group of agents and likes to do his transfer business in a kind of face-to-face way. Then you've got this sort of dying analytics department, which Jason Rosenfeld left over sort of the lockdown to go and work with Arsene Wenger at FIFA. Now, who is the ultimate authority in this group? It's not Arteta. Arteta is just part of a... So apparently at Arsenal, the club decides which positions they're going to strengthen. And Arteta, his influence comes in defining the type of player that they want to fit into that hole. Now, that's a précis of the situation. So who do I blame when it goes wrong? And Durabjian, I think he prefers the term advisor rather than agent, apparently. Why is he your kind of your proxy spokesperson during this situation? We've got all kinds of unjustified new contracts being signed, and I'm hearing a lot from somebody who isn't employed directly from the club. That's never ever in the history of the game been a sign of good health, a sign of organizational good health. So what Arsenal need before we start worrying about what Mikel Arteta is going to be tactically, you know, what his long-term trajectory is as a head coach in Europe, You need some simplification. I need to know who I blame when something goes wrong. If I'm an Arsenal fan, I want to know who I'm holding responsible. And I wouldn't know that. I'm a Tottenham fan, so I can point and laugh. But if I was an Arsenal fan, then I want that accountability. Surely it's like anything. Like a football club is like, a FTSE 100 company or a political party. You have to be able to give supporters the opportunity to ask questions to the right people through whatever medium. And I have no idea who that would be at Arsenal at the moment. And that's quite a strange position to be in.
Yeah, they're acting, if I'm charitable, counterintuitively, because we live in an age of increasing the analytical element of recruitment is very important and will continue to be so. There was some talk about Arsenal going for the Dortmund model: buy young, add value, develop. Well, if that was the case, why not
get rid of Mislintat?
Who actually, incidentally, is going up from Bundesliga 2 with Stuttgart this weekend. So there is strange. It is really strange. I was just Jordan, I want to get your view on the contract situation because, you know, a number of questions surround what's happened there at Arsenal this week. David Luiz, why? Why another a year? Cedric, jury was out on him at Southampton, injured throughout his six-month loan. Suddenly there's a four-year deal on the table. Gamble, at best. Marry, limited evidence to give him 4 years probably. Meanwhile, no new contract as yet, although Arteta says it's in the pipeline, for Bakary Saka, who they should be moving heaven and earth to keep. What's going on? What's the logic to all that?
It's an absolute mess, Mike. Absolute mess. I think the reason, we start with David Luiz, that he's been given a contract is twofold. I think one, I think alongside the other defenders that they've signed in this week is a sign to me as an Arsenal fan, I suppose the football world, that Arsenal are broke. Arsenal have no money to spend this summer. And I think they're just doing the numbers game. They're thinking, well, we're not going to be in Europe next season, more than likely. We can't go out and buy an Upamecano or a player of that caliber. Let's just, you know, solidify the centre-backs that we do have. So we go into the new season with, I believe it's five. So Sokratis, Luiz, Holding, Mustafi, who am I forgetting? One more. Mari.
You got Chambers in there as well.
And Chambers as well.
Yeah.
So that, Harding, Mavropanos is out on loan summer, isn't he?
There you go. So that's the pool of defenders. They're thinking, right, worst case, we know the start of next season, we've got 5/6 centre-backs. I think they're all rubbish. I think they're all, none of them are good enough personally. They are, they're all rubbish. But I think it's the thing of, we don't have any money to spend. So let's just lock down the ones that we do have. I often hear this thing about David Luiz where, he's good behind the scenes. He's good in the dressing room. Well, listen, if it's keeping the troops, you know, lively and spirits high, pay me some money. I'll do it for a few hundred quid. Pay me. I'll come in. I'll G them up. I'll make them laugh. I'll sing a song. I'll do a dance. I can do that completely. That's not... Why are we... Arsenal are such a mess right now. These deals... For me, just show, as you mentioned, they're not short-term deals, apart from they're four-year deals they're giving now on players that either have injury problems or haven't even kicked a ball for Arsenal. Arsenal as a football club are in real bad shape. And this whole mess of this last week, Man City, Brighton, and the subsequent contracts we've seen being offered out, show me one thing, and it's the thing that Arsenal fans need to understand. Arsenal are not a big club. They are no longer a big football club. Big football clubs don't lose their best players every season. Big football clubs compete for the best football players in Europe. Big football clubs don't consistently lose to the bottom half teams on a regular basis. Arsenal are not a big club, and until they realise that and the fan base realise that, they're going to always be disappointed, heartbroken, and in this sense, confused.
So your cup's half empty, Jim? It's said, you know, that Arteta is probably, you know, almost in the right place at the wrong time, and or he should have actually maybe kept his powder dry, waited for Everton to turn up. You know, he's got a whole raft of problems.
He could walk. Sorry to cut you, Mike. It wouldn't surprise me. It's a big shout, but it really wouldn't surprise me if between now and the first game of next season, he walks. I think he may think this is going to harm my managerial career. What the hell have I walked into? It really wouldn't shock me if he decided that, if I can't get any money, if I can't get players out the door, your Mkhitaryans, your Ozils, your Mustafis, your Luizes, what the hell are you doing to my career? I could see him walking.
That's an interesting one. He's got to sell Guendouzi as well, hasn't he?
I mean, Guendouzi, he's a riddle, isn't he? I mean, he's one of those guys that sort of he shows up when he at the moment that just let's look at the Brighton game, because I think that was kind of him as caricature. So when the final whistle goes, he's the first player fronting up Neil Maupay. But when the game's on the line, when that pass is played in towards Connolly, which Maupay runs in on, he's the Arsenal player that doesn't cut out. If you look at the footage, that is a ball that you should block. You should be never, ever allowing a pass that simple into an opposition centre forward in the 93rd minute. I think there's a player there. I think he's very talented. I've married into a family of Arsenal fans, and they
good
all
man,
rate.
Good man, yeah, good
well,
man.
I don't know about that, but they all rate, and I see their point, because I think he's a really good passer of the ball. I think he's just very immature. I think he's a young man that needs to grow up. I mean, we talked about, in a previous episode, we talked about Trent Alexander-Arnold, 21 years old, world at his feet, already European champion. Guy has a mural in his own city. And you see the way he carries himself, and you compare that to the way Guendouzi carries himself on the pitch.
But the difference is, I agree completely with what Seb just said. I think there's a player in there. I think that I think there's a guy that, but I do agree also with the Brighton point that he was an absolute mess on that game. But I think Guendouzi is a victim of what's happened at Arsenal for many years. A young, talented player that has been elevated way too soon because he has no generals around him. Jack Wilshere was the same. We flood these youngsters, these teenagers in, and within 2 years, they're the main centre midfielder. How can you be at 2021 the main midfielder in your team rather than being next to a Vieira or next to a Keane? And I think if we're not careful, Arsenal are going to lose another talented young player. One, he needs to grow up. But I think part of that growing up would be next to a senior pro that could say, listen, this is what we're going to do now. We need to mature a little bit and just talk him through games. Bring him on for the last 10 minutes of games. He's our main midfielder. How has that happened? I think that is where I think we won't see the fulfillment of his potential.
You know what's really interesting, guys, is that I wonder whether, Jordan said earlier, like that Arsenal aren't a big club anymore. And I kind of disagree because I think they're a club that they still have a huge profile. And if you play for that club, you still exist in a very bright spotlight. Now I wonder whether for someone like Guendouzi and his personality traits, like, as Jordan said, he's kind of come in and he's almost become like a senior figure in the team. He's become when he first arrived, he was someone a lot of fans clamored around and said, this is a really good player, this is our future. Now, for some types of footballer, that's a problem, especially when they're young, because you become the big man before you've actually achieved anything. And I see kind of those sort of behavioural traits in him now. The way he carries himself is someone that's sort of three Premier League trophies down, and you know, who's been a European champion and who, you know, is a veteran international. That seems to be his demeanour on the pitch. And I wonder whether that is, in a kind of abstract way, in a sort of very tenuous way, a consequence of Arsenal's own situation, whereby, you know, when a player like that comes in, there's a desperation, there's this tendency to prematurely promote them and put them in a position where people think, right, this is a guy now, this is a star of the game, well before they're actually able or capable of handling that kind of attention.
I think what we're doing here is we're talking about a club which has lost its soul or lost its identity in probably the way that West Ham have. You know, you've got owners who, you know, are basically looking at the business plan rather than anything else. There is an undercurrent amongst the supporters that they are being taken for granted at great cost. Given all that, this might be another painful one for you to answer, Jordan, but...
At this point, I'm numb.
can you see Sheffield United doing a number on them?
I can. I really can. I didn't understand the outrage and the shock to the defeat against Brighton last week. Brighton, I believe I'm right in saying the last five games against Brighton, Arsenal have only won once, and I think we've lost two of those five. Going back to the Sheffield United, Man United game, we were praising Solskjaer United's performance in that game. I think a lot of that was because Sheffield United's legs have gone. They just seemed, I think that they're one of the big victims of the lockdown. They just seem to have really lost huge momentum and their legs have gone, and they enabled United to have so much space to play the football they did. I think this is a really interesting and important game for Arsenal, because on one side, I'm saying that I think Sheffield United's legs have gone, and in theory, it could be a good time to play Sheffield United. But I think Sheffield United will be thinking equally, this is a good time to play Arsenal, because they're in absolute pieces. And this could be the game that gets our season back on track and enables us to finish the season strong. I think Chris Wilder, like a lot of football managers now, like I think Graham Potter did with Brighton on the weekend, tell their teams, just stay in the game for an hour. Just stay in the game for an hour. Even if you're 1-0 down, we'll take that. It's Arsenal. Just be in the game. So I genuinely feel that this is a really interesting game for Arteta and for Arsenal, because if this slide continues and they get knocked out of the FA Cup, then I don't know where Arsenal go from there, because an FA Cup for a few teams that are left in this competition could prove a bit of a salvation in terms of saving and masking a season for many teams. So I think Sheffield United, I think for both teams, this is a good and bad fixture to have, if you like.
Yeah. No, Leicester are another team who've not been impressive in the restart. Okay, it's very small sample size, two matches. They're at home to Chelsea on Sunday. You know, I looked at them. They seem to me, Seb, to just need a bit more creativity and probably a better balance in midfield just to restore their momentum.
Well, I mean, if the rumours to be believed, they're on the verge of doing that. I think they will complete a transfer for William Carvalho from Betis within the next few days. He's a sort of different profile to anything else that they have, very complete sort of footballer. Looks a little bit like an accountant. which is just a funny one.
He turn up with a briefcase.
Yeah, well, he does. He's got some very neat pencil thin moustache. He looks like someone that you would meet in an accountancy firm, but a really good footballer. So he'll drop in and presumably play alongside Wilfred Ndidi next season. I wonder, Mike. I've got a few concerns about Leicester. I think this is what it looks like when you know that your Premier League season is secured. It's very difficult, as we found out over the years. You cannot motivate players out of that in a sort of flicking the switch sort of way. And I wonder at the same time whether, I mean, we always talk about focusing on certain competitions and we talk about the Champions League, FA Cup. I don't know if it's that easy. I don't know if with Chelsea on the horizon at the weekend and, you know, with an FA Cup there to be won, let's face it, whether Brendan Rodgers can restore the kind of the sharpness of the creativity. Like the urgency, like you see it all over the pitch. I don't think there's any one problem with Leicester. You see all these sort of, you know, there's defensive errors in there. I mean, I know they didn't score it, but the penalty conceded to Brighton was sloppy, I thought. The equaliser conceded to Watford was, I mean, you shouldn't be conceding 93rd minute equalisers to centre-backs with bicycle kicks. It just shouldn't happen. That is not the symptom of a good football team that's sort of, you know, behaving as it should. So I wonder, I mean, I think it's a kind of, you know, I don't want to say that they're on the beach, but it's a powering down. It's less dramatic than what's happened to Sheffield United because Leicester are much more talented, so they can survive in a sort of a, you know, at a higher level. But it's a similar situation, I think.
Yeah, Seb mentions the level of talent, and you know, you look at that team, you've got players who are routinely linked elsewhere. You know, Ndidi, Maddison, Chilwell. Jordan, are you surprised there's been no real push for Kasper Schmeichel? And where do you think he ranks amongst the best goalkeepers in the Premier League?
I'm not surprised, because I think the counter question then would be, where would he go? Mm. So Liverpool, City,
Chelsea?
Possibly Chelsea and maybe even Spurs. I've never, ever been convinced about Lloris, even when he was playing well. So I guess there's a couple of clubs there that are possible options. I feel like the boat may have been missed with Kasper Schmeichel. I think the time to maybe try and get him out of Leicester would have been maybe just after they'd won the Premier League when he was at the peak of his powers. I still think he's a top keeper. I would rank him top eight, definitely top 10. I'm a big fan of Patricio at Wolves. I think Leno is a very good keeper. I don't think he's in that top tier. And then you've got the top two of Edison and Alisson at City and Liverpool. I would put Schmeichel on par with maybe David De Gea now, but that says more about, I guess, about David De Gea than it does about Schmeichel, if I'm being honest.
The final quarterfinal, Newcastle, Manchester City. Let's look at Newcastle. You know, we can't detach any discussion about the team without we look at the ownership and, you know, the psychodramas in court about involving people who are involved with the takeover. Are there just too many question marks about that club for them to actually do anything?
This season, yeah, I'd say so. Which is a real shame, because supporters have been waiting an awful long time to get to this, to sort of have a competitive cup run. Because if you remember sort of Ashley's Newcastle at their very, very worst, there was this terrible disregard for cup competitions. I think even, you know, back in the day, Derek Lambias was even on record saying that you couldn't survive if you took the cup seriously, which is just nonsense. I don't know. It seemed like a backwards justification for not developing the squad properly. I think you're right, Mike. Even if Amanda Staveley wasn't in court at the moment, even if the takeover wasn't happening, is that team actually good enough to win the FA Cup? I think the stars really need to align, because I'm not convinced by their ability to attack properly. I think they can defend quite well. I think they can break quite well. I think if you put them up against a team of power, a team with, let's say, Manchester United's resources and firepower at the top of the pitch, I think they've got issues. I'd even say the same thing about, you know, if they were to come up against Arsenal in a semi-final, for instance, because I don't think they're built to sit and break against a team that have a, you know, for instance, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang at the top of the pitch. So it's difficult. But what's in their future, I'm not sure. I mean, I wonder what it's like for some of those players too, because if you're someone like, for instance, I don't know, Matt Ritchie, good Premier League player, probably not going to survive long term if the takeover goes ahead and if the money comes into the club. I wonder how you view it mentally. Like, is this a sort of a last dance situation, that, you know, a chance to leave the club with a medal or some sort of form of achievement? I don't know. I mean, it's such a rare scenario that it's very difficult to predict.
There is a distinctive love of a certain type of player at Newcastle. You know, Saint-Maximin is probably, you know, really fits into that. You know, the Geordie ethic, if you like. They love you know, the ginolers. They love people who actually entertain, in inverted commas. To be honest, it's a bit like having a rascal shirt, isn't it? You love the colour and you love the cut of it. But if you're wearing terrible trousers, it doesn't really work. And I think that's probably what it's like with Saint-Maximin. He's a decent player. He's a, you know, very interesting player to watch. But frankly, where's the end product? You know, I know that's an old cliche, but where is it? What do you think, Jordan?
You just described my fashion sense there in one. So thank you very much, sir. I agree with you. I think there's lots of elements of an exciting player. But, you know, how much can you package that to say, OK, this guy, I know I'm going to get this from him. I don't know. But I think maybe some players like him, we shouldn't try to package too much. I think we just have to just accept him for what he is. I don't think he's the sort of guy that's going to get to a top six club. But I think he's the guy that can have an impact at a top 12 club, as Newcastle probably are now. So, yes, they would love to have more end products out of him than they're probably getting. I just think if you're going to have a player like that and keep him, you have to accept that one week he's going to score you a hat-trick and get an assist. The next week he's going to miss two open goals. And I think Newcastle is a club that, as a fan base, I think in a really weird way would accept that. The entertainment levels almost match the output of what they get. And that's not to be patronising, say they don't want to win anything. But I think that a team like Newcastle would warmly accept someone like him for all of his possible flaws as well. I think Almiron, very briefly, is the bigger problem. I think he's a championship player. I think he's a bigger problem, that he has nice, neat touches, but he's lightweight. He has no end product as well. I think he'd be the one, if I was a Newcastle supporter or manager, would slightly concern me going into next season.
Yeah, there's a final point. Let's look at the FA Cup as an institution. Yeah, I'm a great believer in an FA Cup. And I suppose, you know, because it's coming back at a concentrated stage of the season, there will be a lot more attention on it. Just want to get your views on it, guys. How important is it? Is it still valuable, or is it a piece of tradition that, like, you know, we talked about the League Cup maybe being realigned in some way because of the extra demands on people? Is it something worth protecting, I suppose?
Absolutely. I mean, importance kind of splits into two categories, doesn't it, Mike? Is it important to me as a fan? Yes. Is it important in the kind of hierarchy of achievements in the game today? Not really. You don't remember cup final days in the way that I used to when I was a child. You don't look forward to them in the same way. You don't really remember season to season who lost the FA Cup final. You don't have these stories anymore. But as an occasion, as a kind of, in terms of fulfilling like traditional part of football, which is every dog can have its day, you know, you need to have that straight knockout competition, because I think as time goes on, league competition is built to, is built to glorify the teams that are owned by sovereign wealth funds and who can, as we're seeing at the moment, you know, bring on five Kevin De Bruyne's in the 75th minute. The FA Cup isn't like that. I just for sake of prediction, this isn't based on any inside knowledge or anything, but I think the League Cup is on its last legs. I think the coronavirus will see to it. I think there'll be a renegotiation between the Premier League and the Football League over this. And I think in a funny way, that might restore a little bit of the luster of the FA Cup, because you need to have it. You need to have those weekends where, you know, you've got John Motson wearing a sheepskin coat, and you've got, you know, local ground staff who have been drafted in as, you know, from normal jobs as school janitors, clearing snow off a pitch in the middle of January. That staff is part of the foundation. That's the foundation block of English football. These things are an integral part of the history. And for as long as the FA Cup exists, that will still remain the case. So it's great. Whether it has any cachet, that's a really different question. And I suppose if we were to be having this conversation in 10 years' time, it's an even different one, even more different one, because who knows what the texture of European football will look like by then. But I still enjoy it. And that's really what matters. I'll still watch it. So it really is as simple as that sometimes.
So, Jordan, will you be out in the streets with your Rascal shirt and your Arsenal scarf when they win at Wembley? Does it matter to you, not just as an observer of the game, but also, you know, the kid who grew up with the game?
I think to many people, the FA Cup starts to matter when you get to the latter stages. It doesn't. You don't really care about it until you get to the quarterfinals, and all of a sudden you got a chance of winning it. It's the most important thing in, you know, in the world. And as I said earlier on, I think it can act as a saviour for your season. I think if Arsenal were to win the FA Cup, I think if Chelsea were to win it as well, United, that would put a plaster over, you know, for United and for Arsenal, definitely an average to poor season. For me personally, it doesn't resonate with me as much as it used to. I don't get excited about the early rounds anymore as I used to. You know, if you'd ask me the last five FA Cup winners, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Now, I'm not advocating that it should be scrapped, but if I'm being honest, I don't care for it as much as I used to. However, I think that probably says more about where we are in the current football climate of the we're in the Champions League era, we're in the, you know, the glitz and glamour and the money era, where the FA Cup just isn't really a part of that. And if you were to lose the FA Cup, what does that say about a cornerstone of English football's heritage? So while I wouldn't be in favour of scrapping the FA Cup, if it was scrapped, I wouldn't be shedding too many tears.
Well, I suppose, you know, I'm an unashamed football romantic. I still adore 3 p.m. kickoffs on a Saturday, the smell of onions from the burger vans, black boots, all that stuff. And in that context, I'm really looking forward to this weekend. I think it should be a good one, and I hope you enjoy it too. So thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast, and have a good weekend.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.